5-18-2643, Kevin Summers v. Touchpoint Health Plan, Inc. Arguing on behalf of Touchpoint Health Plan, Inc. is Attorney Robert J. Dreps. Mr. Dreps? Oh, I'm sorry. I've been reminded Justice Prasso will not be participating.
Court, I am Robert Dreps, and together with my colleagues Brian Cahill and James Peterson, I represent the defendant Touchpoint Health Plan, Inc. As my client's name suggests, the dispute we're here on today involves payment for medical benefits under an employer-sponsored plan administered by Touchpoint. The plaintiffs, Kevin and Amy Summers, and their family are participants in a health benefits plan funded by Mr. Summers' employer, the Kimberly-Clark Corporation. The dispute arises from Touchpoint's denial of coverage under the plan for post-operative treatment the Summers chose for their son, Parker, who had developed a rare cancerous brain tumor at the age of 3. This treatment, high-dose chemotherapy with stem cell transplant, was the subject of a Phase 2 clinical trial to determine its effectiveness in treating children with this rare brain cancer. Touchpoint denied coverage for the treatment because it is experimental, as that term is defined in the plan. Despite that denial, Parker received the treatment, and at last report, he has made a full recovery.
Now, is there a debate as to whether it's experimental under the plan and that it's what a Phase 2 experiment?
No, that is not disputed, Your Honor. The complaint alleged that the initial proposal was to enroll Parker in an ongoing Phase 2 clinical trial. His treating physician, Dr. Pacetti, recommended that as the best available treatment for his condition, given his age, and the plan unambiguously defines experimental.
So was he in that? Was he in that trial ultimately?
He was not enrolled in the trial. He received the identical treatment without participating in the study.
So is it your position that that if there's a trial somewhere in the country, indeed maybe in the world, that's in Phase 2 and experimental, but that in other hospitals it's standard treatment, that your company is going to deny coverage? I mean, is that your position?
The terms of the plan, I say this.
Because it's a matter of experience. You go to one hospital and XYZ is standard treatment in that hospital. Patient moves to another state and go to a different hospital, both excellent hospitals. You want to continue the patient on XYZ. And the other hospital says, can't do, that's not standard. And we can't do that without our rigmarole in the hospital and the health insurance, et cetera. So what may be experimental in one community, this doctor may be issuing an order anyway.
Your Honor, the plan tries to precisely define what is experimental by requiring that it be, among other things, the subject of a Phase 1 or 2 clinical trial. There is no evidence in the record that suggests what is considered a subject of study in one area can be considered standard treatment in another. Mm-hmm. In this case, certainly, the condition is so rare that I think it's conceded that there are no standard treatments. In fact, part of the plaintiff's position was that every treatment postoperative for this condition is experimental somewhere. But the plan does not purport to cover every service that a physician determines is necessary or appropriate.
So if it's experimental somewhere, your position is that it's not covered by the plan?
The plan defines experimental in a way that's intended to limit the plan administrator's discretion in determining that. They can't simply say, we consider it experimental even though it's standard treatment somewhere else. It has to fit the definition of experimental in order to be excluded. But if it does meet that definition, the plan administrator is required by ERISA to deny coverage.
And what's the definition of experimental?
In this context, it is any service, supply, drug, device, treatment, or procedure that, and the third condition is the subject of any ongoing phase one or two clinical trial.
Counselor, just for definition's sake, the phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trials, those denominations, where do they come from? Are they NIH denominations for experimental treatment? Where do they, or are they some other denomination that the plan thought of?
These are standard denominations, well accepted within the research community, as I understand it. Dr. Pacetti, Parker's treating physician, described them in her affidavit in the record, saying a phase one study determines the most effective manner in which to give a new treatment and the safest dose to administer. A phase two study has the purpose of determining whether the treatment effectively destroys cancer cells. And then a phase three study compares the treatment being researched to standard treatments to determine which are most effective. The plan unambiguously excludes treatments that are the subject of a phase one or two clinical trial, but if it's the subject of a phase three clinical trial, if it's made it that far in the process, then the administrator has discretion to cover the treatment if it is, in his discretion, determined to be as effective as other available treatments for the condition.
Counsel, I want to follow up the Chief's question because I'm concerned about the scope of any decision we're going to issue here. If you have a phase one or phase two clinical trial, as is defined in the policy, that it's taking place in New York, the state of New York, would that be covered under this policy?
No, it would not.
If you have a phase one or a phase two clinical trial that is taking place in China, would that be covered under this policy?
I don't believe that clinical trials are conducted in that manner. It may have Chinese subjects. It may be a worldwide study, but I believe
Let's
it would
say
be
Germany.
In the United States.
Is it limited to the United States? I'm trying to figure out what the scope is. Is it limited to the United States? Does it include other parts of the world?
That issue has never arisen to my knowledge under this plan, and so I think the administrators would have to exercise the discretion the plan gives them in making that determination. My understanding, though, is that these are United States-based clinical studies, even if they include foreign subjects.
Mr. Drebs, given the fact that this is a very rare condition, is there any post-operative treatment here that would have been paid for by Touchpoint?
The Touchpoint plan did cover follow-up care by the surgeon who removed Parker's tumor.
What's follow-up care?
He continued to monitor the patient's condition to see if the tumor redeveloped. So he was observed and tested as a protocol to ensure that he would get necessary treatment if any further treatment was required. The purpose of the stem cell transplant with chemotherapy was to enhance the likelihood that the cancer would not reoccur. And after the initial denial by Touchpoint, the Summers requested a referral for a second opinion, and Parker was seen by a physician at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin who recommended a different protocol, chemotherapy with radiation treatment.
Would that have been covered?
That is one of the issues in the case. The Summers never asked Touchpoint to cover that treatment, so they never studied whether or not it was the subject of a phase two clinical trial. It turns out that it was. The recommending physician, Dr. Maloney, did not indicate in her referral or in her recommendation for this treatment that it was the subject of a phase two clinical trial. So at his deposition, 2 years after the initial coverage denial and Parker received the treatment his parents chose, the Touchpoint administrator, Dr. Harms, was asked whether or not the radiation treatment Dr. Maloney had suggested would be covered. And he initially responded yes, because he did not know that it was the subject of a phase two clinical trial. The deposition questioning continued. He was asked the basis for saying it would be covered, and he said, because it is not the subject of a Phase 2 clinical trial.
Doesn't this get us,
then, excuse me?
Doesn't this get us into the question of whether or not the coverage here is illusory?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, for several reasons. One, it's an objective fact whether or not a treatment is the subject of a Phase 2 clinical trial. If the health care administrator was confused on that subject, it was only because it wasn't studied. In the initial request for the treatment Parker received, Touchpoint created a record of 150 pages evaluating whether or not this treatment was covered under the plan. And all of that was submitted to the independent reviewer for consideration, and ultimately that determination was affirmed. The radiation therapy was never studied at all. The only thing in the record is the two-page recommendation itself, which does not say whether or not it is the subject of a Phase 2 clinical trial. At his deposition, when Dr. Harms was asked to assume that this radiation treatment was the subject of a Phase 2 clinical trial, he testified unequivocally that it would not be covered if that was the case. He was asked, what if every treatment for this condition was the subject of a clinical trial? His answer was, then there would be no coverage under this plan for that treatment. And that does not render the policy illusory. The policy nowhere promises to cover every reasonably medically appropriate treatment for every condition. It has explicit exclusions, and that is spelled out to every recipient and participant in this policy. On page 27, which is attached as part of our appendix, under restrictions, limitations, and exclusions, under the subheading important, it states explicitly, even if a physician or other provider prescribes, recommends, or approves a service or supply, Touchpoint Health Plan will use your certificate of coverage to determine whether or not that service or supply is a covered service under Touchpoint Health Plan. This is a contract, and it has to be interpreted and applied as a contract. It has exclusions, and every participant member understands that. That's the way our American health system works.
Counsel, in response to the questions asked by the Chief Justice regarding definitional concerns in this policy, there was a discussion of whether or not it was Phase 2 versus standard treatment. And you use those terms, and I even see that the policy itself makes reference, perhaps not with regard to Phase 2, but Phase 3, that we're looking at clinical trials versus standard treatment. What happens, and this really follows up the Chief's question, when it is in a phase of trial, but it is also a standard treatment?
I understand those terms to be inconsistent.
Well, let's look at your own expert's report, and by that I mean the independent expert, Medical Review Institute of America, that you contacted to do a reevaluation of this case after Touchpoint denied coverage. And in relevant part, and I refer to appendix page 34, the doctor is Dr. Thomas Moss, and apparently has lots of credentials, as I read part of his curriculum vitae, says, I would recommend approving the proposed therapy as it would be one of the standard approaches for three-year-old children with this disorder. It is one of the treatment approaches that would be used by most any pediatric oncologist. There is no alternative with superior or proven results and is therefore medically necessary. So I've got a concern when your own, or when the expert that you hired for review refers to this as a standard approach. It would be used by most any pediatric oncologist, and it's medically necessary. How do you deal with that?
Well, Your Honor, first, This is not a retained expert of touch points. This is an independent reviewer.
I understand that. I mean,
that is a requirement of ERISA that a claimant be entitled to get an independent review of a coverage denial.
Nevertheless, your medical director indicated that he agreed with the report. That's referred to on pages 35 of the appendix.
And that's absolutely correct. He does agree with it because the conclusion is that this is defined as experimental under the plan.
Well, the conclusion conclusion section has two paragraphs. The first, you're absolutely correct. The first paragraph ends or is real short. It says, based on the policy language submitted, the proposed therapy meets the criteria of experimental, therefore the previous denials would be upheld. The second paragraph, and there are only two paragraphs in the conclusion and decision, which your medical director approved. The second paragraph of the conclusion and decision is what I read. This is standard approach. There's nothing better, and it's medically necessary. So is it your position that the medical director, in signing off and approving this, only approve certain paragraphs and not other paragraphs?
Oh, certainly not, Justice Bradley.
That's not a fair question. Let me take it back.
I think he meant every word he said here. However, I think he was careful in his language. He said it's a standard approach for people with this condition, not that it is standard treatment. I don't think anybody would fund a clinical study of a treatment that was already accepted as standard.
Well,
intended to determine whether or not it is medically appropriate so that it should become standard.
Okay, let me just read the words because they speak for themselves as to what he said. I would recommend proving the proposed therapy as it would be one of the standard approaches. You're absolutely right. For the 3-year-old children with this disorder. However, the next sentence says, it is one of the treatment approaches that would be used by most any pediatric colleagues.
I think it's unfortunate that the reviewer used that language because he is, in fact, quite literally inviting the Touchpoint Health Plan Administrator to abuse his discretion, to violate ERISA, and to award coverage for treatment that he says is contrary to the policy language. ERISA commands administrators on pain of liability to apply plans as they are written. That was Congress's objective. Our system of health care encourages employers to provide health care. The way we encourage them to do that is by ensuring, guaranteeing under federal law that their written plans will be administered and interpreted as they are written. Exclusions for experimental care are common to health plans.
Yeah,
State law, Wisconsin law, expressly permits that type of exclusion, even apart from ERISA's permission.
Counsel, is there a difference between a clinical trial and an experimental?
Experimental can be defined in many ways. Here, one of the concepts that makes a treatment experimental is if it is the subject of a phase 1 or 2 clinical trial. But by definition, the reason it is the subject of a clinical trial is because it is not yet proven effective, it is not yet accepted as standard treatment, and that is not uncommon for such a rare disorder, particularly in children so young.
Counsel, maybe you can help me with this because maybe this is not an area that I have a great deal of experience with, so I'm looking for answers. It would seem to me that for purposes of ongoing improvements in medical care, whether we're talking about medications the development of ongoing medical treatment with respect to different types of medication or with respect to other surgical procedures, that it would always be to the industry's advantage to constantly review, constantly have trial, constantly research to improve the treatment on an ongoing basis. So when you say that you would never have a phase 1 or phase 2 clinical trial if it was standard care, is that in fact a correct statement, or does it automatically go down to phase 3? Because there are trials all the time. I'm sure there's a trial somewhere in this country involving bare aspirin. going on somewhere. So at what level is it no longer experimental? I mean, do you understand the gist of my question?
I think I do, Justice Bradley.
Butler.
I'm sorry, Justice Butler. The
we can change name tags here.
I mean, the people who pay for these studies are not the people who pay for health care. I mean, there are a lot of players in this industry. The question suggests that clinical research is somehow gamed in order to protect the interests of the people who pay for health care. Well, that, I think, is not in fact the case. Academic researchers are motivated to help patients gain better health. Payers for medical care are motivated in this circumstance, employers, to recruit employees. If they craft a healthcare policy that affords so few benefits that a competitor is more attractive to a qualified employee, the employee is going to go there and the employer is going to be out of luck. On the other hand, experimental treatments are generally hugely expensive and could impair any employer's ability to cover routine care for his or her employees if, in fact, they're compelled to pay for it.
I understand
their
argument
about... Their
option
would be to say, I'm not going to provide coverage at all because they're not obligated to do that.
I understand your argument about experimental treatment, but it's how you've defined experimental treatment. And I guess my question goes to specifically to the way it's defined here, phase one or phase two clinical trials. And your suggestion, and it may be in fact accurate, and that's what I'm trying to press you on, your suggestion is you would never have a phase one or phase two clinical trial for standard care. And I'm just asking you, is that in fact correct, or can you have phase one and phase two clinical trials while a treatment procedure has been deemed to be standard?
I think it is inconsistent to suggest that a standard treatment could be the subject of a phase one or two trial, because they are defined as clinical studies to determine the effectiveness of a particular drug. Now, you can certainly and commonly study whether a drug approved for one use is effective for another. The chemotherapy used in this regime is already standard treatment for adult cancers. I'm not sure the extent to which it's non-experimental with respect to childhood cancer, but in combination with stem cell transplant for this rare condition, it is undisputed in the record that it is experimental and the subject of a clinical trial. There are many trials underway that test whether a drug approved for one use in fact might be effective for another one. That requires a clinical trial before a physician can simply prescribe the drug for some other condition. It has to be proven effective. And health plans commonly do not pay for that kind of treatment because it hasn't yet been proven and accepted by regulatory authorities as effective for that treatment.
Counselor, is there anything in the record that tells who paid for this phase two study?
No. Who is funding the study, I don't believe, is part of the record. At least I'm not aware of it.
Thank you. So what did you want to talk about in the 5 minutes that you got left, counsel? We've engaged you in a conversation
I thought I might spend a little time on the remedy that the Court of Appeals chose here.
Okay. Does that mean you concede that the second letter wasn't good enough?
Well, the second letter plainly did not literally comply with the regulatory requirements for a denial letter.
Right.
You need only compare it to the first letter to see that it lacks detail about the reasons.
Okay.
The case law standard, of course, is substantial compliance. And the issue is whether the Summers received sufficient information to obtain an independent review. And in this case, I think they did, because the question presented is so simple. The only question is a matter of plan interpretation. Does it matter if Parker is not enrolled in the study if he gets the same treatment that is the subject of that study? Is it still excluded? They didn't need a lot of information from Touchpoint in order to get an effective independent review of that determination. In fact, that's precisely what they got in the circuit court. In the circuit court, they argued that it is a reasonable interpretation of the plan that it should cover whether or not he's enrolled in the study. The Court of Appeals correctly, in my view, ruled that the plan terms are unambiguous. The plan does not refer to whether the participant is enrolled in the study or is the subject of the study. The plan excludes coverage if the treatment is the subject of a clinical study, and that has never been disputed in this case. In hindsight, certainly the second denial letter could have specifically addressed that claim and should have. But did it serve the purpose of enabling the Summers to understand Touchpoint's position and obtain an independent determination? Of course it did. That's what they got in the circuit court. And that's the only remedy the regulations provide for an inadequate notice letter. The coverage determination was correct, even if it was not adequately explained in the letter.
But counsel,
and ERISA requires it be upheld.
Weren't you saying in your argument that the communications should all be viewed together when determining whether or not the letter was adequate?
That's right, Justice Ziegler.
Okay.
And I think understood in context with the original letter, the determination was that the change in not enrolling him in the study did not change the conclusion under the same exclusion that was detailed in the first letter.
Thank you, Mr. Dreps. You Thank have you. 5 minutes in rebuttal. I believe your counsel for the Consumer Law Litigation Clinic of the University of Wisconsin Law School. You're representing the Summers.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Stephen Miley. I'm the director of the Consumer Law Litigation Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. I'm joined today by Eric Goldman, who's a third-year law student currently enrolled in the clinic, also by my co-counsel, James Gardner of Lawton & Cates. Also in the courtroom this morning are Kevin and Amy Summers, whose son Parker is now a healthy 8-year-old boy in the fifth year of remission from brain cancer. Parker, of course, is at the center of this lawsuit. And really what this lawsuit is about is consistency and transparency and the lack thereof. Consumers, particularly those whose family members are in the throes of life-threatening illnesses, expect, and ERISA requires, that HMOs apply their policies consistently and fairly, and that when an HMO denies coverage for some kind of treatment, that denial must be clear and informative so that the consumer knows how to proceed. Touchpoint failed on both counts in this case and with respect to Parker Summers. First, Touchpoint applied its experimental exclusion inconsistently, both during Parker's treatment and throughout the course of this lawsuit. Secondly, Touchpoint's second letter of denial failed to provide any explanation of the reasons justifying that denial. Accordingly, Touchpoint's conduct in both instances, its inconsistent interpretation of its contract, its second denial letter, was arbitrary and capricious. And the proper remedy for that is the reinstatement of benefits to Parker and to his family.
Counsel,
yes.
Are you arguing that the here on appeal, that the language of the plan clearly provides coverage for you?
Justice Bradley, we are arguing that the language of the plan, as it was inconsistently interpreted by Touchpoint, does allow for that coverage, because by either covering or agreeing to cover other treatments that were the subject of phase two clinical trials, and here I'm talking about observation alone, which they did cover, and then the chemotherapy plus radiation, which at different points in this lawsuit they seem to say that they would be willing to cover, that by doing that, but then by failing to cover the treatment that was the most effective, that was superior to all other forms of coverage, as several justices noted in their questioning, that kind of by inconsistently interpreting the experimental exclusion, they in effect waived it.
You're not arguing, are you, that the terms of the exclusion are ambiguous? I mean, I hear you arguing inconsistent application and wrongful denial regarding the second letter in terms of explanation, which constitute arbitrary and capricious. I do not hear you arguing here today, nor did I see you arguing in your briefs, that the Court of Appeals was wrong in its interpretation of the exclusion language, which states in sub 3 under experimental, is the subject of an ongoing phase 1 or 2 clinical trial or furnished in connection with medical or other research to determine its maximum tolerated dose, et cetera. You're not arguing regarding the interpretation of that language. It seems to me you're here arguing regarding the application of an unambiguous interpretation.
Well, that certainly is our one of our principal arguments, but I think...
That was multiple, so you can't tell me what... are you here arguing that it is inconsistently applied, but that the definition is unambiguous?
Well, Justice Bradley, what we had argued below and the Court of Appeals did not reach was that the contract was illusory because it was so broad as to swallow up every conceivable type of coverage that was available for Parker's condition. Now, the Court of Appeals didn't reach that point. Now, if Touchpoint had consistently applied the experimental exclusion throughout its treatment of Parker, then we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't be making the argument with respect to their waiving of that exclusion. But we do think that the policy language is vague, and in fact, Dr. Pichetti reasonably interpreted that language to cover Parker's treatment if he was taken off of the clinical trial. Because
is that on appeal? I mean, I read your arguments. I just want to know what the issues are on appeal. Are you contesting and appealing the Court of Appeals determination that this provision, this language is clear and unambiguous? Are you appealing that?
No, we are not, Justice Bradley. We are not appealing that. But the reason it's still significant, one of the reasons is that Dr. Pichetti's interpretation of it was reasonable, and the Court of Appeals did not say that it was that her interpretation was unreasonable, because had it been unreasonable, then they wouldn't have taken Touchpoint to task for having failed to respond to it in their second denial.
If her interpretation is reasonable, I'm going to infer that it follows that Touchpoint is also reasonable. And if it's reasonable, how can it be arbitrary and capricious?
Justice Bradley, the reason it's arbitrary and capricious is, again, that they interpreted that language inconsistently, that they covered treatments that were clearly subject of a phase 2 clinical trial. And because of that inconsistency, then again, effectively waived their experimental exclusion, which is arbitrary and capricious.
How would they have not been arbitrary and capricious in this case? What would they have done? What would the insurance company have done in this case, starting at the very beginning, so that their position was not arbitrary and capricious? Would they have said, we are not going to pay for any treatment of this youngster because all of the treatments are experimental?
Under the terms of their experimental exclusion, that's correct, because...
So they should have paid zilch here because all of the treatment plans were experimental.
Well, there's no evidence in the record as to the surgery, and there's been no contention that the surgery by Dr. Iskandar was subject to...
The surgery was okay under the plan, in your view, right?
There's no evidence that that's
okay.
Subject to a...
So what? When did they move off the surgery, and when did that treatment become experimental?
During post-surgery, Chief Justice Abramson, when they started observing Parker in the way that Mr. Drepps referred to monitor him for possible recurrence of a tumor, that observation alone is the subject of a phase two clinical trial. So once they started covering observation alone, they were indeed covering treatments that under their definition of experimental were experimental.
Where was that experiment carried on? That you observe, the experiment is you observe after surgery? Is that the experiment?
That's correct. You monitor, you perform, the patient, it's either in the hospital or the patient comes in periodically for checkups, that sort of thing.
Counsel, I'm a little confused by a portion of your argument, and I want to make sure I'm following you accurately. It seemed to me from going through the briefs, and your brief in this matter, that one of the arguments that you were making is that, look, what we have here is a course of treatment, and the course of treatment includes the surgery, it includes the observation after the surgery, includes the postoperative decision-making process, which would include the plan that was recommended here. And if I understand the briefs correctly, your opponents were taking the position, no, these are separate identifiable matters here, and you have to treat each one separately, and we have to make the determinations independently. And as I heard your argument just now, it seems that you've kind of bought into your opponent's point of view. Am I reading you correctly? Have you abandoned that this is one treatment, one course of treatment, and it's all covered, and we're dealing with not a termination situation, but a denial situation? Or are you still arguing that there's termination here?
Justice Butler, I certainly did not intend to backtrack from the point in the briefs that this is a continuing form of treatment. That is, the treatment for cancer begins at the point of surgery and continues throughout observation and through some form of follow-up treatment through recovery. That it is one procedure, one process, and that if a plan is going to deny treatment during that continuum, then they have to comply with ERISA in terms of the denial letter. And if they don't, the remedy for that is reinstatement of the benefits.
Your argument is based on their position, they're internally inconsistent. Is that your point?
I'm sorry, just
your argument is based on their position, their argument is internally inconsistent. Is that your position?
There's really two different arguments. I mean, the internal inconsistency goes to the issue of the way they interpreted their experimental exclusion. The second argument is the one that the Court of Appeals ruled in the Summers' favor in terms of the deficiencies in the second denial letter. And as the Court of Appeals held in that part of its decision in ordering the remedy, that cancer treatment is a continuum, starting with surgery up through observation and whatever follow-up treatment is necessary.
Counselor, just to give you a hypothetical to be sure I understand, if someone had a heart attack and they were brought into the hospital and stabilized for the heart attack, and then open-heart surgery was performed and they were followed and didn't do well, and then a heart transplant was the only course for them, are you saying that would all be one course of treatment?
Yes, Justice Rogensack. We would. It may depend on the particulars of the type of disease, but I think it's the same scenario. And that, again, it doesn't mean that every single type of treatment is going to be covered. The Hackett case doesn't say that benefits must continue indefinitely, but if they're going to be interrupted, that interruption must be communicated to the plan beneficiary in a way that complies with ERISA.
Well, I guess my question really went more to follow up on Justice Butler's pickup from the argument in your brief that we don't really have several courses of treatment here. We have one course of treatment. And so my example was, and you answered it, that you would consider that one course of treatment as well.
Yes, Justice Rogensack,
I would.
Why is the remedy that the Court of Appeals gave here, a restoration of all benefits, the appropriate remedy, in your opinion?
Justice Crook said it's the appropriate remedy because in situations where you have a continuing course of care, when a plan denies those benefits at some point because of an inadequate letter, denial letter under ERISA, the appropriate remedy is the reinstatement of the benefits that the plan participant was receiving. So it's proper in this case because, again, the treatment that Parker was receiving was a continuing form of care and treatment.
Is your argument in regard to remedy any stronger on a finding of arbitrary and capricious, or is it stronger on an argument that this is an illusory contract?
Well, I think it can be equally strong. I think that with respect to arbitrary and capricious, it's quite clear that the second letter meets that standard because, again, it gave no reasons for the denial. It referred to no particular provision of the Touchpoint policy, and it did not refer to Dr. Pichetti's proposal that Parker be treated off trial. And there's no dispute that Touchpoint was aware of Dr. Pichetti's recommendation in that area. And that fails to meet even the substantial compliance standard under ERISA.
Counselor, if yes. The language of the exclusion is clear and unambiguous, which is how I think you answered Justice Bradley's earlier question and how the Court of Appeals decided it, it doesn't matter whether he's the subject himself of the trial, it's the treatment that has to be the subject of the trial, isn't it? I guess I don't understand your last concern about the fact that he was given the same treatment off trial. Unless you're telling me now you think the language is ambiguous, then I would understand that argument.
Well,
but I don't.
Again, Justice Rogenczak, the Court of Appeals did not dispute that Dr. Pichetti's interpretation of the policy was
I'm not talking about her interpretation. I want you to focus on whether you are telling us the language of the policy is clear and unambiguous. And I know Justice Bradley pushed you on that because it's an important point as we try to figure out what to do with this case. I thought you said it was not ambiguous. And the language talks about whether the treatment, not the child, but the treatment, is the subject of a Phase 2. Unless I misunderstood you, I thought you said that was clear. Did I misunderstand you?
That's correct, Justice Rogenczak.
Okay, so if it's clear, then what does it matter that Dr. Pichetti recommended treatment with the child not being part of the Phase 2 study, as long as it was the same treatment which was encompassed in the study? I'm not understanding the argument.
Okay, Justice Rogenczak, the reason why it's significant is Hackett and its progeny of cases with respect to denial letters is not about whether or not the plan participant is entitled to the benefits. It's about whether or not the letter of denial satisfies the criteria in ERISA. And that's what the Court of Appeals focused on. And because it didn't satisfy the criteria of ERISA, and we had a continuing course of care, the deficient letter was arbitrary and capricious, justifying the remedy. Okay. So the issue of whether or not these benefits should or should not have been provided is irrelevant in the Hackett analysis.
Okay, so it's simply focusing on the second letter and its brevity.
And its brevity. Yes.
Okay,
Justice.
I understand now. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
But if I can follow up that question, as I understand at least the question by Justice Crooks, that the arbitrary and capricious, I think you would argue meets the standard that there was a violation of ERISA here. I'm missing a connection. How does that get you to the remedy that you're arguing for?
Well, it gets to the remedy in the way that the Court of Appeals held that the remedy was appropriate, which is that when there is an arbitrary and capricious denial of ERISA benefits in a situation where you have a continuing course of care, the appropriate remedy is the reinstatement of benefits to which the plan participant is
entitled. Which means we would have to accept your argument that this is a termination of benefits as opposed to a denial of benefits, correct? Isn't there a distinction?
I don't think that it was certainly a denial of benefits here. I don't know that distinction between denial and termination.
If I understand the cases that were cited in the briefs, there's a different line of cases depending upon whether or not you're terminating ongoing treatment versus denying treatment in the first instance. That's what I'm trying to focus on.
Right. That's correct. And cases such as Hackett deal with situations where there are ongoing benefits and then they're terminated as opposed to an initial denial. And you're correct, Justice Butler, that we're talking here about the termination of benefits that have been ongoing. Yes.
What's the standard of review here?
The standard of review is arbitrary and capricious in terms of looking at the
because the plan
conduct.
Gives the administrator discretion. Is that it?
That's correct. That's correct.
And what's arbitrary and capricious? The second letter, or arbitrary and capricious that they view this as experimental, even though he's not in any experiment? What's arbitrary and capricious here?
Well, yes, Chief Justice Abramson, I think there are a few examples of arbitrariness and capriciousness here, and you've touched on two of them. One is the second denial letter, and I think we've gone over that. The second is the manner in which they inconsistently interpreted their experimental exclusion. As this court held in the Evans case, when a plan interprets its contract inconsistently and uses inconsistent basis for making decisions, that is arbitrary and capricious. And it's also arbitrary and capricious.
What was inconsistent here? Well, you agreed that the surgery was okay, right?
Correct.
Under the plan. Okay. So where were they inconsistent about what they said was covered? Is it that the radiation chemo was experimental and they said they'd cover it? That what was inconsistent?
Yes, Chief Justice Abramson, that's correct, that they said that at different points during the course of the lawsuit that they would have covered that. But the other instance of inconsistent application of the experimental exclusion was when they were covering observation alone in the period immediately following Parker's surgery. And
their view is that that observation amounts to what is the terminology, a service? Is that what you're?
That's correct. And
it's not a drug, right? Maybe, but it's not a treatment. You're just observing. Their position is that that doesn't fall within their exclusion.
Well, Chief Justice Abramson, I realize they say it doesn't fall within the exclusion, but their exclusion references phase two clinical trials, and there's no dispute that there are ongoing phase two clinical trials that of which the subject is observation alone.
So you're saying after a surgery, if a physician observes the patient, that is not just conforming with accepted medical practices, that is then part of a trial phase two test?
Well, Justice Ziegler, the problem here for Summers is that the contract, the exclusion, doesn't speak in terms of standard treatment. It speaks in terms of phase two clinical trials, and that's what they chose to cite when they refused to cover the recommended treatment by Dr. Pichetti, which again, as Dr. Moss concluded, was medically necessary, superior to all other forms of treatment. But that's what they use to deny the coverage, and yet at the same time, we've got clinical studies involving observation alone that presumably should also have fallen under that experimental exclusion, but they were covering it. That's inconsistent application. That's arbitrary and capricious, and under this court's holding in Evans, that justifies the award of monetary benefits.
Thank you.
I don't know if this case is the same as Hackett. I have trouble reading Hackett, but it seems to me in Hackett, it's arguable that they terminated improperly, but that the patient there was under that plan was always entitled to the remedies, that is, to the treatment and to the coverage by the insurance policy. It's arguable here that the termination was improper, that is, the refusal to pay was improper because there weren't, the second letter was not adequate. But that, as to use the language from Hackett, it's a windfall if under the policy your client was never entitled to payment for this. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yes, I understand, Chief Justice Abramson. And the answer is that this case is like Hackett. And it's like Hackett because, again, the care, the cancer care, is a continuing course of treatment to which Parker was entitled. And so after the deficient letter of denial, under ERISA, he was entitled, his parents were entitled to payment for that continuing care. In this case, it was medically necessary treatment. There's no dispute that, that was medically necessary, that it was the most appropriate care for someone of Parker's age and condition.
Suppose you have patient Z, and patient Z is given all of the ordinary, standard, usual care and treatment for this disease. None of them has worked. Nothing has worked. And the physician says the only thing left is that there is an experiment, is a drug, which is not yet marketed, but is being clinically tried, and it's in phase two, as we use those terms, which I'm not sure where they come from, of experimental. So we can now put you on that drug, and it costs $1,000 a pill. You know, I'm not going to put you in the trial because if you're in a trial, it looks to me like you're not covered. So I'm just going to, I can get this. Now it's continuing care, right? So what, are you covered under that, under this policy, under your argument of continuing care?
Well, again, Hackett is not about whether or not the participant is entitled to coverage. Hackett is about the adequacy of the letter.
All right. So let's put it where you write them, or they, and they say no experimental, or they, and they give you a letter that's not good enough. I want two answers. One, suppose they write you and say, give you all the explanations, and the letter is just terrific. I want to know, under your argument of continuing care, does it cover an experimental drug?
No, because in that case, okay, the plan has complied with ERISA, which didn't happen here.
Okay. But if they don't comply with ERISA, in my example, then you say, you're on. That's the remedy is, I get the drug.
Yes, as long as it's part of the continuing course of care, which in your scenario it is.
How can it be that the letter determines whether it's a continuing course of care under the chief's example? I mean, you said the first time there's no coverage if they give you all the reasons under the plan why it's not covered. And then the second time you say if the letter is deficient, there is coverage. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me because the plan has got to say what the plan says, doesn't it?
Well, Justice Rogenczyk, again, if the letter is deficient, it's Hackett doesn't say that it doesn't speak to the policy and whatever the relevant policy is.
But the letter can't create or eliminate coverage that would otherwise be under the policy, right?
No, but what it does is it says because it's deficient, you have to reinstate the benefits until such time as you write a correct letter, a letter that complies with ERISA. We're going to put the patient back in the position that they were in terms of receiving this continuing care until such time as you deliver an adequate letter that sets forth the reasons for the
delay. I suppose 2 weeks later they sent an adequate, in this case they sent an adequate letter saying this is experimental, even if he's not in the experiment and we're not doing it, and you had a five-page letter and et cetera, then it would not be covered? Is that your argument here?
Well, it wouldn't be covered under the Hackett line of case. Not that it wouldn't be covered. There wouldn't be retroactive reinstatement of those benefits under Hackett. Now, of course, we might still be here on the first argument in terms of the inconsistent application of the experimental exclusion. But in terms of Hackett,
because chemo radiation is experimental in your view.
Chemo radiation is subject to phase 2 clinical trials, as is observation alone. Yes.
This may be a bit repetitious, but I just want to settle it in my mind. And that is, let's say there's clearly no coverage under the policy. No doubt about it. And forget this inconsistent application. That doesn't exist in my hypothetical. There's clearly no coverage under the policy. The letter is deficient. The remedy?
The remedy is the reinstatement of the continuing benefits until such time as the letter is correct.
The remedy is the status quo, and then you get back to, is this continuing course of treatment or is this a new requested treatment? And then that gives you the two forks of what the remedy is. What prevents your opposing counsel right now from handing you a letter?
Well, Justice Bradley, they've had 5 years, and
okay, well, right, you know, no time like the present. and now that's it, you know.
I suppose you should ask opposing counsel.
No, but under your argument, as of now, if the treatment was still ongoing, there would be no, aside from the inconsistency, there'd be no payment. But for the last 5 years, they'd have to pay. I mean, if I understand your argument.
Well, if they came up with the letter.
There was no denial in effect. They never denied because the denial was ineffective.
Well, Chief Justice Abramson, I mean, the difficulty and probably why they're not writing the letter now is because the treatment is finished. It was successful. It's too late, essentially. But had they written a correct letter a week after the first one, perhaps before the treatment was actually rendered, and it was correct under ERISA, then the Summers, under the Hackett theory, would not have been entitled to retroactive award of the benefits.
You'd be here on inconsistent. Some experimental they're allowing, some they're not, and you don't know why. They're making the difference.
That's correct.
If I can, Chief.
No, go ahead.
To follow up on Justice Bradley's question, as I understood your argument, it would put you back to the status quo. And I want to press you on that a bit. The treatment that the doctor was prescribing here with respect to the chemotherapy and the stem cell recovery, was that subject to a pre-approval under the plan? In other words, did they have to get permission first to go ahead, or was this something that would have taken place but for the denial? Do you understand my question?
I believe so, Justice Butler. Frankly, I would have to check the record in terms of whether, but my assumption is that certainly in order to get coverage, they would have to ask for pre-approval. But of course, Dr. Pacetti went through with the treatment in any event after receiving the second denial because she felt that it was the best alternative.
And that's why I'm asking the question. And because if it puts you back to the status quo, the inappropriate letter, if that gets you back to the status quo, and if the status quo is you have to seek approval for the treatment, and that approval has not yet been given, then is there coverage unless we reach the illusory argument?
Yes, there is coverage, Justice Butler. There's retroactive payment of the benefits because, again, Parker was receiving benefits pursuant to a continuing course of his cancer treatment.
But maybe I'm not making my question clear. If you had to have pre-approval for this benefit and the pre-approval had never been granted, then if you're going back to the status quo, don't you go back to the point where the insurance company would have to determine whether to approve or not? Isn't that the status quo?
Well, again, Justice Butler, the status quo is that he was receiving benefits under the plan. He had received surgery. He had received observation following that surgery. So, and as Dr. Iskandar said in his letter after surgery, he referred Parker to the pediatric oncology clinic here at UW with the express purpose of a continuing course of care that would follow with some form of treatment. Parker was within that continuum, and again, by denying the recommended treatment without the proper ERISA letter, the Summers are entitled to retroactive benefits.
According to the Court of Appeals, this goes back to the trial court for further proceeding. What kind of further proceedings would there be under the Court of Appeals decision?
The Court of Appeals decision remanded for, I believe, calculation of what the appropriate monetary award would be, depending on the cost of the procedure and that sort of thing.
Is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision you think would be a mistake if this court just said, hey, we're adopting the Court of Appeals decision? Could you have written a better decision and differently? It's well, another way of stating it.
That's a loaded question, Chief Justice. Well, of course, they didn't reach a couple of our other arguments, the illusory contract argument and the inconsistency.
Yeah, but if you win, you don't need to win on three. You just need
That's
to win
true.
On one.
That's true.
In this particular
That's true.
Case.
We had hoped for a de novo standard of review. They adopted the arbitrary and capricious, although, frankly, it really doesn't matter because the conduct here by Touchpoint was clearly arbitrary and capricious.
Anything else?
That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Krebs.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin with Justice Butler's question about whether prior authorization is required under the health plan. It is. The provision of the plan requires prior approval by the Touchpoint plan medical director in the case of any treatment that isn't prescribed by the primary care physician. Parker's condition was so rare that he, of course, was beyond his primary care physician, and that required his physicians to seek prior approval for each step in the service they provided him. In fact, the initial denial was of a request for prior authorization for the treatment. Secondly, I do not think Hackett is properly applied to a health benefits plan. It is a disability benefits case. The plaintiff there had received disability benefits every month for 12 years when the plan denied his continuing coverage under circumstances the court concluded were arbitrary. The court said it wasn't adequately explained because the plan did not explain why they accepted one physician's determination that he was no longer disabled and discounted other medical evidence in the record that said he was still disabled. The court therefore ordered coverage reinstated pending a proper determination. The subject of the case at all times was whether or not this man was disabled under the terms of his plan. There was a dispute over the medical evidence. The court said under the circumstances of the arbitrary cutoff of your 12-year stream of benefits, we're going to order coverage reinstated while that is properly determined under the terms of the plan.
Even though he may have been perfectly able in that interim period, Mr. Drebs.
That's true.
Okay.
So he,
which would have been a violation of the contract.
The court very carefully said that they are not determining whether or not he is entitled to continuing benefits. That is subject to redetermination under the plan by the plan administrator.
Going forward.
going forward.
Okay.
I think comparing a disability plan to medical services plan is apples and oranges. This plan specifically requires prior authorization for each service that a member participant receives. Secondly, even if Hackett were applied to this case, the status quo is denial. The initial request to provide Parker this treatment and enroll him in the study was denied. The court said, you're free to get that treatment, but we will not pay for it under this plan because the employer's plan doesn't permit it.
Counselor, what about counsel's argument that observation is a treatment that requires, that's part of a phase two experiment?
That argument is based upon a two-page printout of an internet description of a clinical study. There's no further analysis in the record of this study. It is titled Observation or Radiation Therapy and or Chemotherapy and Second Surgery in Treating Children Who Have Undergone Surgery for Ependymoma. So it's post-surgical care that's being studied. And the title does begin with observation. But observation is not the subject of the study. It is not treatment to watch a patient and see if a tumor redevelops. The purpose of this study is specifically described. Phase two trial to determine the effectiveness of specialized radiation therapy, either alone or after chemotherapy and second surgery, in treating children who have undergone surgery for localized ependymoma. What they do is gather a sample of children who've had this cancer and had the tumor removed. Those who redevelop tumors receive the specialized radiation treatment to see if it is effective. That's the subject of the study. Other lucky children whose cancer does not redevelop are only observed. That's not the subject of the study. Observation is not experimental.
Well, there are a number of studies where there's surgery, and one group of patients elects not to take chemotherapy. Another group of patients elect to take chemotherapy. They both had surgery. And then the experiment is to observe both groups to determine the survivorship rate, right? And all you're doing is seeing, do they live 5 years or don't they live 5 years? You can find that, many of those on the internet, depending on what kind of disease you're looking at. Would that fall into experimental in your plan?
The chemotherapy treatment would.
No,
that's the subject
of
the study.
This is after surgery and after chemotherapy. They have 10,000 people in both of these. Enormous study, big data bank to see who survives.
Control
breast cancer.
The control group who receives no treatment is certainly part of the study.
Well, they receive
surgery.
But observing
them is not the subject of the study. We're faced with a catch-22 here. If we cover observation, if we even examine the patient following surgery, we're accused of inconsistent application of the exclusionary treatment exclusion, of the experimental treatment exclusion. If we do not cover anything post-op, we're accused of having an illusory plan. Well, you can't have it both ways. This exclusion is clearly spelled out in the plan. It is authorized by state and federal law, and it must be applied according to its specific terms. Illusory contract is a state law concept that is preempted, as is the waiver argument that was presented earlier. The court should look
at the... How would you write the opinion? How would you have written the Court of Appeals decision opinion?
I would have written the Court of Appeals decision to affirm the circuit court's finding first that the exclusion is unambiguous and it applies whether or not the patient is the subject enrolls in the clinical study. Secondly, I probably would have agreed that the second letter was deficient under the ERISA standards. Simply by comparison to the first, it did not have a complete explanation of the reason for the second denial. But I would have concluded that, nonetheless, the proper remedy for that is to allow a free pass to court to deem all of the plan conditions satisfied, that's the regulatory standard for a deficient notice, and allow immediate avenue to court to determine coverage under the terms of the plan, to get an independent and fair review.
You don't think you should read both the letters together? You don't think that's an option to read both the letters together?
Certainly I would read them both together. But my point is, are they still deficient
if you read them both together?
I did certainly argue, and I still believe that, read together, the Summers had a perfect understanding of the reason for the denial and that it is substantially compliant. I only suggested that it doesn't literally comply with the regulatory standard viewed alone. However, the point is that it doesn't matter because the only purpose of that notice is to give the participants sufficient information to obtain an independent review of their entitlement under the terms of the plan. And that's precisely what the Summers got in the circuit court. Their argument that not enrolling Parker in the study entitled him to coverage was fully aired and rejected correctly under the unambiguous terms of this plan. And ERISA does not permit a different remedy. To order coverage that is excluded under the plan is to punish for the absence of a few additional sentences in the denial letter.
Well, maybe you should pay the attorney fees.
I don't think that's a permitted remedy under ERISA either, because the coverage was correctly denied. There was no error in the coverage.
You did something wrong, right?
Or we wouldn't be here.
That's right. That's right. So you did something wrong. And what, for sake of argument, Mr. Drepps, what you did wrong was the second letter, and that's arguable too, but the second letter was not good enough. Okay. So do you go home scot-free? I mean, your client has attorney fees too, but you did something wrong. Ordinarily, if you do something wrong and you do cause issues, I mean, as you say, they're entitled to an independent review, which is costly, right? So, you don't really suffer a penalty other than you went to court, which may be a big enough penalty.
ERISA is not about penalizing plan administrators for errors in the processing of claim. It is about ensuring that participants in plans receive all of the benefits they are due under the written terms of the plan. That purpose was fully satisfied here when the circuit court heard and carefully considered the Summers' argument for coverage on the grounds that Parker did not enroll in the clinical trial. So that the error, to the extent there was one in the second denial letter, does not entitle them to some sort of punitive remedy. That would itself violate ERISA. The ERISA statute does permit fee shifting to a successful participant who prevails in a claim for benefits that were improperly denied. But here, the premise and the only conclusion that can be drawn from the unambiguous language of the plan is that the second denial was correct, even if it was inadequately explained.
Chief, may I ask one quick question? In your oral argument earlier, you indicated that the Court of Appeals found that the language was unambiguous with regard to the important section.
Justice Bradley, if I said that, I misspoke. I meant the Circuit Court found the language unambiguous. The Court of Appeals did not address whether the language is ambiguous or not. They did not find that there was coverage under the plan. They found that coverage should be ordered on this course of treatment rationale that purported to reinstate the status quo, even though the status quo was treatment coverage denied.
So the Court of Appeals found that your client arbitrarily and capriciously denied coverage for his ongoing treatment in the second letter. And the appropriate remedy is to remand, to reinstate. You have anything else you want to say within 10 seconds?
Thank you,
Well done, Mr. Rouse. Well done. Thank you for your excellent arguments on a very significant issue, not only to these particular clients, but in terms of ERISA and generally on health insurance coverage for dreadful diseases and very difficult treatments thereof. The happy thing here is we've got a lad who's in good health. That ends our argument on 2005 AP 2643, Summers versus Touchpoint Health Planning. Thank you, counsel. The court will take a few moments in recess to allow people who wish to leave to leave.